Ibn Ezra was one of the most important, influential, most heavily discussed, and also controversial biblical exegetes, that's Mefarshim and normal language of the Rishonim. His commentaries are often very hard to understand. He's not the most transparent writer. He has a great kind of flair for literary style. He tends to use jargon, philosophical jargon. He was extremely well-educated for his time. Astronomy, philosophy, poetry, grammar. Tends to be very terse, very elliptical. Sometimes he deliberately hides what he's trying to say. He tells you this is a sod and it's only for the elite who have the necessary background. Sometimes it's just his style is just so opaque. In any event, though, the Ibn Ezra was, we don't realize today, I think, even how influential, how important the Ibn Ezra was. I think I once heard that there have been several hundred super commentaries written explaining the Ibn Ezra. Some of them are quite short, just a few lines, but a friend of a friend of mine was once a collector, I think, of Ibn Ezra super commentaries. I think he had assembled several hundred, 400 or something. In his day, it was basically Rashi, the Ibn Ezra, the Ramban, you know, were kind of the three most important, most influential of the early to middle medieval commentators. Also, the Ibn Ezra was also very controversial, as we'll discuss today, largely because of his disregard and even overt criticism of explanations and positions of Chazal. That's really what I want to explore today, discuss what exactly the Ibn Ezra did, what he thought he was doing, what the reaction to some of his critiques of Chazal were. We'll open with a very interesting, very problematic passage of Ibn Ezra on this week's parasha, Parashas Tzav. The introduction to this actually comes in last week's parasha, Parashas Vayikra. The topic is chalev. Chalev are the forbidden fats of an animal. We're not allowed to eat chalev, it's an iser karis. Today, the chalev are largely parts of the hindquarters of the animal. Today, certainly in the United States, we don't bother with taking out the chalev. We simply discard the entire hindquarters, the acharayim. We sell it to non-Jews. We let them take it. We just eat the front of the animal. It's simpler and more efficient. In earlier times, where Jews couldn't always do that, there was an elaborate procedure of nikur, where there would be very elaborate traditions. Some recorded in the Gemara, some were oral traditions, where they would actually have experts called bale menachrim, who would actually be experts on exactly which fibers, which pieces of the meat would have to be removed. That's chalev, very serious issue, along with gedanasha and dam. Once you have a kosher animal, there are three things you have to get rid of: the blood, the gedanasha, and the chalev. And chalev, of course, we know chalev applies to any animal, chutzlar, Eretz Yisrael, during the temple era, bizman hazeh. We're not allowed to eat chalev, and it is a very stringent prohibition. So the Ibn Ezra on last week's parsha, when the Torah describes the karbanos, when the Torah describes the sheep, so chalavim and the Torah appear in two contexts. One of them is that the chalavim have to be offered on the mizbeach. Even a carbon like a shlamim, which is largely eaten, the chalev has to be, the chalev is the section that has the part that has to be offered to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the altar. On an ola, everything is offered on the shlamim. The chalavim are offered. When the Torah discusses a sheep that's a shlamim, the Torah lists the specific items that are called chalev. The Torah says, regarding tzon, it says, v'hikru mizevach ha-shlamim ishe la-Hashem, chelbo ha-aliyah t'mima. The aliyah, the tail, is one of the fats, one of the portions that has to be offered on the mizbeach. However, the aliyah has a unique status in terms of chalev, that the aliyah, although it is offered on the mizbeach for a carbon, in chulin, in an ordinary animal like we have, it's allowed to be eaten. Most of the chalavim, the ones that are offered on the mizbeach, cannot be eaten even on chulin. The aliyah is the exception that proves the rule. It's offered on a carbon, but it may be eaten in chulin.
Is that chalev in it?
It's called chalev. Well, that's the question. The Torah calls it chalev. It says chelbo ha'aliyah t'mima. It calls the aliyah, all of it or part of it, is called chalev. Nevertheless, Chazal tell us in the Talmud, Chazal tell us that we're allowed to eat it on a regular animal. The Ibn Ezra says, Tohu ha'tzedukim. The Tzedukim erred in this matter, kasher afarish l'cha b'parasha ashniya. As I'm going to explain to you in Parasha Tzav, the Tzedukim made a serious error. Parasha Tzav, in our Parasha, he records his debate with the Tzedukim. Pam achas, he says, bo elai tzeduki achad. Once I had the following dialogue, the following dispute with the Tzeduki. Now, the word Tzeduki here is a little bit of a misnomer. In the Talmud, we have a group of sectarians who are called Tzedukim. They were very active in Bayesheni. again, you read even the New Testament, you read about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Prushim, the Pharisees, that's us, that's the rabbinates, the Chazal, the Armasara comes from. The Tzedukim, the Sadducees, were a sectarian group who rejected much of Torah Sheba'al Peh, all of Torah Sheba'al Peh. They rejected the authority of Chazal. They were Jews, they had Torah Sheba'al Ksav, but they had their own understanding. They were a constant thorn in the side of the rabbinic Judaism at the time.
Could you say that was equivalent to the secular Jews today?
So I want to discuss now a little bit who exactly were the Sadducees and what exactly did the Ben Ezra mean by Tzeduki. So in the time of Chazal, the Gemara doesn't actually tell us that much about what they believed. The Gemara gives maybe a half dozen or a dozen examples of areas in which they rejected rabbinic interpretation. One of the most famous is coming up soon on Pesach. We bring the Karban Omer on the second day of Pesach. The Torah says the Karban Omer is brought me Machras HaShabbos. Chazal understand that Shabbos means the first day of Yontif, the only day of Yontif, real Yontif, the full Yontif Minat Torah. Machras HaShabbos means the second day of Yom Tov. That's when Chadosh becomes Mutter, when you bring the Omer, that's when the Omer is offered. The Tzedukim said Machras HaShabbos meant Sunday. The first Sunday that fell out on Pesach, or whatever it was, that would be the Karban Omer. It was several days off. Famous machlokes between the rabbinates. You see the general idea. They believed in the Torah. They believed in Torah Shebichtav. They had different interpretations. That was a classic one. Another one was the Gemara in Sukkah talks about Nisuch HaMayim. We have a Torah Shebaal Peh, Halacha Moshe Misinai, that one of the avodos, one of the temple services on Sukkos was pouring water, a water libation. All year long we pour wine. Sukkos had a unique offering of water. The Tzedukim didn't believe in it. Another example, the Gemara, there's no pasuk in the Torah. The Torah doesn't explicitly tell us that. Torah Shebaal Peh, they didn't accept. Third famous example was the Yom Kippur service. We say that the Ketoret was put on the coals inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim. They did it outside. There's elaborate discussion in Yuma. They had a problem with infiltration of the Kuna Gedola by Tzedukim, and they used to try to get their men in and do it the Tzeduki way. So the basin used to make them swear, take an oath, they would do it properly, and they used to cry that they suspected him, and he used to cry if he was an honest guy. Major area of controversy. So in the Talmud, we only have about a half dozen to a dozen actual examples of how Tzeduki religious principles differed from rabbinic principles, and those were the Tzedukim in the time of Chazal. We have other historical sources about what they were exactly. 1,000 years later, in the time of the Gaonim, in the time of the Sfardic Rishonim, we find another group who are usually referred to as Karaites, Balei Mikra, Karaim. They were a similar group. They also accepted Torah Shebichtav, rejected much or all of Torah Shebaal Peh. They also differed from rabbinic Judaism in a number of important ways. The Karaim were also a very influential and very powerful group. The Klal Yisrael was split, and they were a serious faction in terms of influence, in terms of numbers, in terms of... Today we look at these groups as being kind of eccentricities of history, and it wasn't like that. Historically, these were very powerful, very important groups. We find in the Gaonim and the Sfardic Rishonim great disputes, great battles they had with the Karaites. The Karaites, you know, wasn't like everyone understood that Orthodoxy was the real religion and the Karaites were somehow second class. They felt that they were the authentic Judaism, and the rabbinates were perverting Judaism with their illegitimate traditions. We find great battles that they had. Perhaps the most famous halachic argument between the Karaites and the rabbinates in the, again, Gaonic and early medieval period was fire on Shabbos. We know, every Jew knows, that on Shabbos we're allowed to have fires burning. We can't light fires on Shabbos. We can't start something cooking on Shabbos, but we're allowed to light a fire on Erev Shabbos and allow it to burn through Shabbos. We leave our burners on Shabbos if we want. We're allowed to take a chalent or a chamim or whatever the different Jewish cultures have, put something on the fire Erev Shabbos, let it cook on Shabbos, and that's fine. The Tzedukim, the Karaites did not accept that. The Karaites said, Lo sivaru eish b'chol mosh v'sechem. The Karaites said, you may not have any fire on Shabbos. They would sit in the dark. They would eat cold food. They refused to have. They thought they were being frumer. They thought they were being more pious, more authentic than the rabbinates. There's a famous comment of Rabbi Zrachi Halevi, the Baal Amor. He famously said that any Jew who does not have hot food in his home on Shabbos, we have to suspect that he has Karaite leanings, Karaite sympathies. He says we're choshishim for minus, for heresy, for sectarian heresy. And he basically says that it's important for a Jew to have hot food on Shabbos. Many have argued that that's a kind of tradition for the modern custom of having cholent or chamim or other types of hot food on Shabbos to show that we reject Karaite interpretation and we allow we allow fire to burn on Shabbos, we just don't light the fire on Shabbos. Now, it's not entirely clear whether the Karaites of the Gaonic period were the same group, were the actual intellectual descendants of the Tzedukim in the time of the Talmud. Again, chronologically, they're about 1,000 years later. It's interesting that they were believed, both they believed themselves and they also were believed by the rabbinate. They were believed, both sides believed that they were descendants. They just said, we're descendants of the good guys, and we said they're descendants of the bad guys. But the point is, it was generally believed that they were a genuine intellectual descent from the Karaites, from the Tzedukim of the Temple period. Today, the historians are not so sure. We don't really have good history of what the origins of these movements were. We don't actually know whether the Tzedukim of Chazal's time actually had this idea of not having fire. The Talmud never tells us anything about the Tzedukim and fire. All we know about that is from the Karaites, from the Gaonic period. In any event, when the Ibn Ezra says Tzeduki, he means the Karaites of his time. I had a friend. Somebody once claimed that it was actually Geiger, the prominent father of the modern reform movement, who was the first to connect the fire thing with the Tzedukim of Chazal and the Karaites of the medieval period. And I was very surprised. I asked a friend of mine who knows this stuff if we could, you know, check the sources of this. So he pulls out his two boxes of, you know, one box of Karaite literature, books on scholarship on Karaites, one box of scholarship on the Tzedukim, two separate boxes. They're two separate areas of scholarship, two separate movements. And indeed, Ataka isn't very clear, and before Abraham Geiger, it isn't very clear who was the first one to come up with this idea that fire was something the Tzedukim wouldn't have done either. In any event, this was a big Karaite problem, and the rabbinate spent a lot of time battling the Karaites on this point. So the Ibn Ezra and our parasha relate to this dispute he had with a Tzeduki, with a Karaite. He says, the Karaite asked me, are you allowed to eat? He says, if the aliyah is considered chalev, the Torah says, ha'aliyah, chel batamima, how can you eat chalev? How can you eat the aliyah? I guess it's the Karaite didn't eat the aliyah. So Ibn Ezra basically says, a lengthy debate, Ibn Ezra basically says, I told this guy that chalev is only usur minat Torah on kunshim, on karbanos. Chalev on an ordinary animal like we have is a rabbinic prohibition, not usur minat Torah. Once it's rabbinic, the rabbis can make up whatever rules they want. Hey, Mamru, they make the rules. So the Karaite kept asking him from various psukim in the Torah that he thought implied that chalev is prohibited on all animals, even on chulin, even on an ordinary animal. And Ezra kept saying, no, if you read the psukim carefully, you'll see that chalev is only a prohibition, midaraisa, only a prohibition on karbanos. For example, it says, kol chalev shar v'chesev eiz lo so chalu, do not eat any chalev. Ibn Ezra says, no, if you look at the context, right before that in Parsha Sab, we're talking about Shlomim and Toda. It's all the context of Karbanos. They went through three or four rounds of this where the Tzeduki kept on bringing Psukim that implied Chalev is always Usser. And Ibn Ezra says, no, it's only talking about Kudshim. It's only talking about Kudshim. Everything else is rabbinic. So we kept on running circles around this Karaite. Finally, the Ibn Ezra records that he won. He won the battle. He says, Uz, Pokach HaTzeduki Einav, the Karaite, his eyes were opened. He declared an oath. He became a Baal Tshuva. He said, I will no longer rely on my Karaite interpretations of the Torah. From now on, I'm going to rely only on the authentic rabbinic tradition. Ibn Ezra records he won the debate. The problem is that the later rabbinic responses to Ibn Ezra they were absolutely appalled. Ibn Ezra is claiming here that chalev is not prohibited midaraisa on an ordinary animal. That's something which is completely against the entire rabbinic tradition. Of course chalev is asur midaraisa. When we take off chalev, we're dealing with nisur daraisa, nisur karis. How can anybody... The Ramban's language in response to this Ibn Ezra is, Ramban, back in Parshas Vayikra, after he spent a lot of time himself rebutting the Karaites, he says... We have to answer a fool according to his stupidity, and the Karaites are crazy, he says, and etc. Then he says, Odas kirtois gadol. I'm also going to have to discuss with you, he says, a great error. Shatar Rabbi Avram, the Ben Ezra, Batanosov, Imahim. His argument with them. Heira lamar mehem. What he said is even worse than them. And again, we're not going to go through his passage at all length, but he says what Ibn Ezra said is worse than the Karaite. The Karaite said all chalev is asur midaraisa, even the aliyah. Ibn Ezra says no chalev is asur midaraisa. No chalev on a chulin, on a non-carbon is asur. That's a terrible, appalling error, he says. How can Ibn Ezra possibly have said such a terrible contradiction to Chazal? The Archaim HaKadosh also has very sharp words for the Ibn Ezra here. He says this is... egregious, intolerable error to say that chelev is not asur midaraisa on chulin is just an incorrect halacha of the worst degree, and a great problem with the Ben Ezra. He could have said such a strange, bizarre thing. One or two other brief examples of cases where the Ben Ezra says truly bizarre things on matters of halacha. We mentioned earlier the great battle between the Karaites and the Rabbinates about fire on Shabbos, where the Rabbinate said you can't light a fire, you can't start something cooking, but you're allowed to light the fire before Shabbos, you're allowed to put something on a pot if with appropriate care taken for Shehiyah and Atmana, of course, and everything else, but you're allowed to leave things cooking like our Cholin before Shabbos. And the Karaites said you're not allowed to do that. So the Ben Ezra records another debate he had with the Karaites there too. This is in Parshas Vayakhel. Of all the 39 malachas of Shabbos, we know that most of them are not explicit in the Torah. The Torah says, Lo sasu chal malacha. The Torah does not actually tell us what malacha is. The one malacha, basically, the Torah tells us explicitly that you can't do on Shabbos is, exactly right, fire, Parshas Vayakhel, Lo sivaru eish b'chol mosh v'sechem b'yom ha-Shabbos. Do not, we understand it to mean, do not kindle a fire. The Karaites understood it meant, do not have any fire burning on Shabbos. So Ibn Ezra, in this version of his commentary, mentions briefly Hagon Rav Sadia. Rav Sadia Gaon, who has also devoted much of his career to battling Karaites, Chiber Sefer Nichbad Shuvus El Achol K'mal Kadmonenu, an honorable, glorious work, rebutting those who dispute our ancestors, the Chazal, in other words. And he mentions Al Ner Shabbos. They disagreed about Ner Shabbos was one of the issues. He doesn't give any detail, but this was the question. Elsewhere in his commentaries, he explains at length what the debate was. And in one version of the debate, I don't have it in my notes here, but in one version of the debate, he told the Karaites that really the prohibition of Shabbos anyway is only Biyama Shabbos, only during the day, not at night. Again, not at night. I mean, of course, the Isra Malach of Shabbos starts at night. Very strange thing for the Ben Ezra to say. Surely he knew that the prohibition of Shabbos begins at night. One of my favorites, a little almost throwaway comment to the Ben Ezra, which is something which is just so blatantly against halacha, is a comment of his in his commentary to Megillas Rus. In the end of Megillas Rus, we have a kind of very puzzling, very obscure passage, kind of a legal passage. You know, the story in the beginning, the narrative story, is interesting and clear. In the end, we kind of have a very muddling, legalistic passage that deals with Chelkas HaSadeh. Somebody was buying a Sadeh from somebody else, and they were doing Yibum along with the Sadeh. Very unclear what exactly is going on over there. Basically, the Psukim describe that Rus had, somehow Naomi and Rus were going to dispose of property that belonged to their dead husbands, Elimelech and Machlon and Kilion. So the Goel was going to buy these properties, but in order to do that, Rus and Naomi had to sign off on the deal. So the Mefarshim struggle at some length trying to understand whose property was this. It sounds like it was Chelkas HaSadeh Asher L'Elimelech. The fields are described as being the dead men who had died tragically in Shdei Moav. So why exactly were Rus and Naomi being asked for their endorsement of the sale? If somebody wanted to buy the property, go find the heirs, whoever the heirs are. Since when are Rus and Naomi authorized to make deals for their dead husband's properties? So there were no sons, that's correct. But that's the problem. The problem is that halacha in Yesh Nochlin has an elaborate system for who inherits in the absence of a son. After a son comes a daughter. If there's no daughter, the next in line is a father. If there's no father, then we pass down to any sons of the father, in other words, brothers or nephews. If not, it goes up to the grandfather, then it goes down to uncles and cousins. But basically, the woman, the wife, a wife is not in line anywhere to inherit property. Al pi halacha, according to the Din Torah of Hilchos Nachlas, a wife does not inherit. A daughter inherits, but a mother and a wife do not inherit. They're not in line anywhere to inherit property. It goes up, it goes down through descendants, up through male ancestors, down from the male ancestors through any descendants again, up back through male ancestors, but a wife and a mother never inherit.
So there's nobody left after the list is exhausted.
So the Gemara actually talks about this. If an entire Shevet in Klal Yisrael, if all of Shevet Yisachar is wiped out, Then what happens? Would it go back? It goes back to Yaakov, then it goes down to another Shevet. The Gemara says, Gemirid lo kol shifta. We have a tradition that no Shevet will ever be completely erased. Now, there are situations where you can't locate any errors, and the poskim do discuss. Practically, in the real world, there will be people. The Gemara always, when it talks about someone who has no heirs, the Gemara talks about a convert. The convert has no heirs because halakhically his previous family are not related, even if they convert too, but the Gemara never discusses like an ordinary person who has no relatives, but practically speaking, you could have cases where there's no relative, and what we would do is a good question. But the point is, even in such a case, there's no rule that we would turn over the property to the wife in such a case. Whatever we would do, we would do. So the main approach, right, the main approach given by the Mefarshim, at least the Mefarshim that I've seen, if you look in the Igera Shmuel, I think it is, on Rus, but written by the 16th century Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael, Rosh Shmuel Diazida, one of the Chachmei Tzfas, and he quotes extensively from his contemporaries, he quotes numerous approaches, and even some of the Rishonim. The mainstream approach seems to be Ksuva. In Halacha, we have a marriage settlement where a husband is required to Alpi Halacha, and often traditionally did, even before that perhaps, settle money on his wife in the event of his death or divorce. He would settle, it's not like today with the estate is split, but he would settle a certain amount of property on her, Masayim Zuz, according to Chazal, more if he wants, commonly, usually more is done. And in general, a woman will have some claim, contractually, mitakonat Chazal, against the estate of her husband, and that is probably, from what I recall, the most popular approach in the commentaries to understand what claim Rus and Ami had to the father's estate. It was a claim of Ksuva. They had died, and they were entitled to at least some chelik of the estate as ksuva. So the Ben Ezra does bring this pshat too. He mentions something about ksuva. He also says, and also the mother inherits He doesn't say wife, I believe he says mother. Gam ha'em yoreshes anisha. Mother inherits. So I'm sure somebody must raise this problem with the Ben Ezra. That's just the most blatantly, you don't even need to know Gemara of that. It's a Mishnah. The first Mishnah, Yesh Nochlin, it says, Yesh Nochlin v'ein manchilin. The Mishnah explicitly says twice that a mother is not Yerish. No way, in any form. The mother is never Yerish in Halacha. Ben Ezra just casually tosses out here that a mother is Yerish in blatant contradiction to the rabbinic tradition, rabbinic Halacha. He says the statement in general form of Haim Yoreshet, but he's coming to explain that pasuk of what right Rus and Ami had. I'm not sure about Rus, maybe Ami specifically, but she's coming to explain what right they had to dispose of the property. And he says, mother's Yerush. So what exactly was Ibn Ezra doing in these cases? And what was the reaction of those who followed Ibn Ezra? So Ibn Ezra, again, as I started out by saying, he was one of the most highly regarded and influential of the early medieval commentators. He was on friendly terms with... No, that was not. That was simply a one-liner, just simple pirush on the psukim. So the Ben Ezra was highly regarded by the Balei Tosus. We have he's quoted once or twice in the Tosus we have. You know, the Balei Tosus discussed, bring a question for him. They discuss his comments. We have a famous letter of Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam corresponded with him, and he writes about the Ben Ezra, kind of a little flowery. We don't write this way, Bizmanazeh, but he writes, Ani Eved Lavram Lamikna, kind of biblical allusions. I am a servant of Avram. The Ben Ezra's name was Avram. Ve'akoda ve'shtachav el'apav. I prostrate myself and bow down to him. He didn't mean he worshipped him as a god. He meant it was a kind of oriental, flowery showing of respect. In general, the Ben Ezra was quite highly regarded by many of his contemporaries, those who followed him. He's one of the most studied commentary. Yet, we also find there were those who were, to say the least, ambivalent about his work. There were those who were angry at him, actually angry at him for his disregard of Chazal. There were those who, may not have been so angry, but simply didn't consider him to have been a great Talmudist. They may have considered him a great biblical exegete, a great grammarian, but didn't, maybe a great philosopher, but didn't consider him a great Talmudist. Besides the Ramban has famous language critical of the Ben Ezra in his introduction to his commentary. Ramban singles out Rashi and Ibn Ezra for two commentators who are going to occupy a lot of his focus and his reacting to them. Rashi speaks extremely highly of. Rashi says, Pirushi Rabbeinu Shlomo, Ateres Tzvi, Tviras Tefara, full of Mikra and Mishnah and Gemara, Lo Mishpat HaBechara, he's the first and foremost of the commentators. B'dvarav Egeb, Avasim Eshkeh, I'm going to study his words, my love for them, I'm going to debate them, discuss them, etc. Then he writes, Imra B'Avram Ben Ezra. Incidentally, I'm not sure what Ibn Ezra's father's name was. Ibn Ezra does not mean his father was Ezra. Ibn Ezra was a family name, basically. We have last names, they had family names, particularly among the Sfardim. There were a number of other famous Chachamim named Ibn Ezra. There was Moshe Ibn Ezra, another medieval scholar. He was more of a poet, I think, and a philosopher. He didn't really write, not as well known in traditional Jewish circles. In terms of Talmudists, we have the famous commentator Yosef Ibn Ezra in the 16th century. He's famous in yeshiva world. He's famous for his work Atmos Yosef, a commentary on Kiddushin. He also wrote Tshuvas and Masa Melech, a very, very distinguished Talmudist in the Turkish Jewry of the 16th century. So Avram, they often wrote Ben Ezra, Ibn Ezra. Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, he says, Tielanu, a famous line, Tochachas Megula V'Ava Mesuteris. Talmudic expression, he says, we're going to have an outward show of reproof, of challenge, of debate. Ava Mesuteris, I'm really fond of him, I really esteem him, but I'm going to, you know, sometimes I'm going to have a show of sharpness and criticism toward him. We have a comment in the Tashbatz. He's probably the kind of one of the first of those to dismiss the Ibn Ezra's Talmudic competence. He writes, in passing in a tshuva, he quotes one of his commentaries, and he writes, wasn't really that expert in the halachic portion of Torah. This was echoed by a passage, probably the most notorious attack against the Ibn Ezra, was a vehement diatribe of the Marshal. Marshal actually appears in the broader context of a polemic against the Shulchan Aruch, against what he feels is the hegemonic attitude of the Sfardim. He thinks they're a little too carried away with their Sfardic authorities. They don't respect Ashkenazic authorities enough. You have to be there. You know, his comments have to be taken with a grain of salt within the overall context of the times. He was very upset at what he felt was a dismissal of the Chachmei Ashkenaz. He mocks some of these people. He says they say that the Rambam is the greatest, and everyone else besides the Rambam is Keklipas Hashum Kenegdo. Nobody counts but the Rambam. Balitosis, they don't give enough. They don't treat seriously enough. And when he criticizes the Rambam for getting a little too carried away for this kind of Sephardic purism, he says that the Rambam wrote a letter to his son. He says in which he told him the Gazer Alav Lilmod Sifrei Achacham Ibn Ezra, to learn the commentaries of the Ibn Ezra. Asher lo haya baal Talmuda, the Ibn Ezra was not a Talmudist. V'rov binyanu perusho al derech atuna v'ativi, his commentaries are based on science and foreign wisdom, he says, Kabbalah chitzonos. And many times he wrote stridently against Chazal, either mibli hashkacha, or mibli yedia, either he didn't care or he didn't know what Chazal said. He says, now lamaisa, he backs down a little bit, he walks back his comments and he says, kvodo b'mekomo munach. I don't want to be too critical of him. Chacham Gadol Haya. He was a Chacham Gadol, even though seems to have a Talmud problem. He was a Chacham Gadol. Amish even Asari, he's dead. You know, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. And he says that many times what he wrote was not really Negei Halacha, and he himself said that he's just coming to. He says that he heard the Ezra, that the Ezra used to say, he's just coming to say how he would explain the Psukim, the Ad Sichla, without Kabbalah. But of course, he was deferential to Chazal. At the bottom line, Ibn Ezra himself says this occasionally, that he's just discussing what he thinks the pshat is. He doesn't mean that's the ultimate MS. Ibn Ezra is not clear what exactly he means. Nevertheless, he says, Lo tzad kudvara be'enai. I think his approach is inappropriate. He says, Kvar nasin alav adin, ki nasin yad laminim. By being so cavalier toward Chazal, he gave strength, he gave succor and support to the minim, the tzedukim, the non-orthodox, the lekalei ha'amuna. Aniha Gevra, Shara, Aniami, I've seen this myself. And for the Rambam to, it's one thing, the Rambam to praise him as the ultimate Chacham that one should study is bad enough. And the Ibn Ezra has a very hard time with this. Not only that, he says the Rambam was so laudatory toward the Ibn Ezra and toward the Tzarfatim, toward the Bali Tosfos. He mocked them, he ridiculed them coarsely, and he said they don't recognize their creator, Elamit Achilas Basar, they have to eat Basar, Ashar, they're physical, they're coarse, they're fleshy. He used very, very coarse terms against the Bali Tosfos. The problem with this Marshal is that the Marshal is basing all this on a comment in a passage of a purported letter that the Rambam wrote to his son. The letter is widely regarded to be a forgery. The Marshal himself alludes to the fact that he isn't quite sure the letter is authentic. He writes, Im Kenhu Mashanimta Bigarto, if this is true, what is published or what is said, B'shem the Rambam, in this letter, if this is true, then I have a great deal of trouble with why with the Rambam's value system, why he raised Ibn Ezra up so lofty, and he ridiculed and wrote coarse slurs against the Baalei Tosfos. If this is authentic, then I have a real problem with the Rambam's attitude. This letter is widely regarded as not authentic. Throughout the generations, there have been scholars, Torah scholars, academic scholars, who have gone back and forth on the question of whether this letter is authentic or not. Yitzchak Shelat, one of the leading Rambam scholars of our day, in his collection of the letters of the Rambam, says that he concludes that it's clear this letter is not authentic. One of his arguments is that the Rambam would never write the way he did about the Baalei Tosfos. He's not saying this on ideological grounds. He says we know from other sources the Rambam had a great deal of respect for the Baalei Tosfos. He may not have seen eye to eye with them on philosophy, but we do know that he respected them as great Torah scholars. We have numerous other letters, the letters to the Chachmei Lunel. He praises the great Torah of the Chachmei Tzarfas. The Rambam would never have used such language, he says, against the Baalei Tosfos. Clearly, he said, this was just some wannabe, some hanger-on with the polemics of the Rambam who were upset at the attacks of the Rambam that were coming from that world. He wrote this coarse, vicious attack on the Baalei Tosfos. The Rambam never would have written such a thing about the Baalei Tosfos. Furthermore, Shelat points out, the Rambam never talks about the Ibn Ezra anywhere else. There's one letter where he mentions briefly the Ibn Ezra in one line. He says, I met so-and-so, here, and who visited me, who was a student of Rabbi Avraham ben Ezra, Chacham or something. That's it. That's the one reference in all the Rambam's work that he ever directly mentioned. He knew who he was, apparently. He mentions him in one letter in passing as the teacher of somebody who he met. And that's it. And all of a sudden, here, in this dubious letter, he's going on and on about how wonderful the Ibn Ezra is. Not conclusive proof one way or another, but so on and so forth. Shelat says that this letter is clearly bogus. I think I heard from Aaron Lopiansky once. He also felt that Shelat was correct over here, that this letter is, Shelat in general is a reliable arbiter on such questions. In any event, we do have Achronim who go back and forth on this question of whether the letter is authentic or not. Rabbi Yaakov Emden felt this letter was completely bogus. He talks about how it's ridiculous and it's preposterous that the Rambam would have written such things. On the other hand, I saw this in Professor Isidore Twersky. Yitzchak Twersky has an article on the Rambam and the Ibn Ezra. He points out that in the Achronim we find Achronim who went both ways. The Rabbi Yaakov Emden believed the letter was a ridiculous forgery. Chaim Sofer, though, seemed to believe the letter was genuine. He doesn't get into all these questions about the Ibn Ezra, but he says that this is apparently, he took it as an authentic letter. And even down to today, some scholars have said this letter is obviously ridiculous, like Shelat. Other scholars were not so sure. Other scholars did not have such a problem believing that the Rambam could have written a letter like this against the Baalei Tosfos and praising the Ibn Ezra. In any event, the Marshal, this letter, authentic or not, the Marshal was quite upset with the Ibn Ezra, felt that his rejection of Chazal, his dismissal, his high-handed dismissal of Chazal, was not appropriate, and gives too much opportunity for the Karaites, for the Tzedukim, for the opponents of Rabbinic Judaism, too much support for their attitudes of rejection towards Chazal. Yes, yes, that is an excellent point, and we'll get to that in just a moment. He's pointing out that the first thing we have to do is distinguish between explaining Torah differently on non-halachic questions and explaining Torah differently on halachic matters. Certainly on non-halachic areas, we find that other Rishonim, Rashi and the Rashbam and the Ramban himself, and numerous Rishonim and certainly Achronim, right and left, go around explaining Psukim, explaining Torah, not like Chazal. It happens all the time. Rashi often says, Zu Medrash Agadah, and this is the Pshat. He doesn't even mention Chazal sometimes. Rashi says, I'm only going to bring Chazal when I need to. I'm not going to bring Chazal when Pashup Pshat is something else. Ramban does this all the time. Many Rishonim do this all the time, and many Achronim do this all the time. So to get upset at the Ibn Ezra for explaining non-halachic passages differently from Chazal doesn't seem like much of an argument. It seems that the primary argument of the Marshal and others were because he explained A, because he explained even some of the halachic passages differently from Chazal, and B, because the Ramban and Rashi and Rashbam were generally more respectful to Chazal than the Ben Ezra was. The Ben Ezra, although in some places in many places he does talk about how Chazal were great and wonderful and masters of Torah, in many other places he talks about their shitas and he uses very sharp language and dismisses pshatim that are theirs. In general, he sometimes seems to express something of a less respectful attitude toward Chazal. We'll go into this in a little more detail in a moment. First of all, discussing the passages we began with in Vayikra and Tzav were about Chela. What on earth did the Ben Ezra think he was doing in these passages? So the general approach, this was said by the Shaul Meshev, by Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, Shir, Rav Menachem Kasher discusses this at some length, other Achronim. The general approach seems to be the Ben Ezra was not claiming that he actually thought chelev of a non-carbon was mutter midaraisa. Rather, he was kind of engaged in a reductio ad absurdum. He was showing the tzedukim that your system is full of holes. Your system is not consistent. You're pretending that you have this simple rule. We just follow the psukim wherever they go. He quotes them as saying, achra kasuv nirduf. We'll just follow the psukim wherever they lead. And I don't want to hear any of this Torah Shebaal Peh. Biblical text, that's it. That's everything. The Ben Ezra was showing them their own shitas ended up with full of holes. And chelev should be mutter. And you should be able to do malacha on Friday night. And he was showing them, you yourself, you don't really take this seriously that we follow literal reading of psukim and nothing else. Your own practice, your own assumptions, which even you agree, clearly show that you're relying on some kind of subtext, something beyond the mere literal reading of the psukim. So as we're saying, so everyone has to have some kind of Torah Sheval Peh. Everyone has to have something beyond the mere raw text. So once you accept that there's something going on here, so we have the authentic ones. You might as well listen to us. Your whole sheet is based on the fact that you think you're biblical text purist. You're not. Everyone needs some kind of Masara. And therefore, you have no advantage over us, and stop pretending you have the high ground. That seems to be the standard explanation in this case of the Chelev in particular. The point you raise is a crucial one, that much of the Ibn Ezra, many of the Ibn Ezras, including the ones in which there was a lot of opposition, are really just on Medrash. So Rav Menachem Kasher makes this point at some length. Rav Menachem Kasher has an essay on Pshuto Shel Mikra in one of his Torah Shleimas, where he discusses, again, how exactly what you said, how many of the Rishonim, including Rashi, explain Psukim not like Chazal. He goes even further. Kasher points out that other Rishonim, including the Balei Tosfos, who in some ways were much more faithful to Chazal than the Ben Ezra was, they were often willing to explain Psukim differently from Chazal on halachic matters all the time, and more than the Ben Ezra. One of the examples he quotes is Rav Yosef of Orleans, Rav Yosef Bachar Shar, one of the French Balei Tosfos. He says he often explains Psukim not like Chazal. One example he gives later in his essay, he says, is the Torah says about an Eved Ivri that an Eved Ivri serves for 6 years, and in the seventh year he does not. He does not serve. Parshat Mishpatim, right at the beginning, the Torah says, Kisikne Eved Ivri, Sheishonim Yavod, Uvash V'yis, Yetzei L'chav Shechina. So everyone probably knows the standard pshat that we never even knew there was another pshat, that it means the term of his servitude is 6 years, and on the seventh year he goes free. Says Rav Yosef Bachar Shar, it means that on the seventh year, which is Shemitah, when nobody's doing any work, he gets vacation because the Eved Ivri was bought for agricultural work, and he goes free during Shemitah, he has a year off. There's another Bachar Shar, which I noticed a little while back when we were learning the laws of Shemitah Stafim and Prusbel. This is not directly contradictory to Chazal, but the Torah says that debts are canceled in the seventh year. So he says, the Shemitah, we have Shemitah Tzafim. Why? So Rav Yosef Bachar Shar says, because they lived in an agricultural society. When a farmer, who borrowed money? Farmers borrowed money. They needed money to run the farms, to buy equipment, buy seeds. How would a farmer repay his debt? By the proceeds of his fields. So the Torah is telling us that on the seventh year, that the reason debts have to be canceled on the seventh year is because there are no crops and there's no... You can't expect him to collect the debt. You have to give him a year off. So whether he means to say that the debt kicks back in after the seventh year, not like Chazal, or he means somehow once he's 1 year behind, we have to cancel the debt entirely. This is not directly against Chazal. It's just an interesting pshat that we often don't think of as a pshat of Chazal. Chazal never really link, except in a very formal drusha way, they never really link Shemitah Safman and Karka. But there are other cases. Kasher brings a few. I noticed one or two. The Din of Shmira B'Bailim and Hilcha Shomrim. Rav Yosef Bachar Shar and many other Rishonim did explain Psukim differently than Chazal, certainly on questions of Drush, even on questions of Halacha they often did. And again, Kasher points out, it's not at all clear why the Ben Ezra came in to for so much more criticism, unless there's a question of tone, of attitude, why he came in for so much more criticism than many of the other Rishonim. Rav Kasher quotes a number of cases where the Ben Ezra takes a very pious view toward Chazal. He makes this distinction explicitly. He says, when it comes to simple pshat, explaining psukim, we have the right to explain however we want, right to learn pshat, to learn Torah, ayin parim l'Torah. When it comes to Chazal, the Ben Ezra repeatedly says, Chazal with a master, when it comes to halacha, Chazal with a master is of halacha. And he repeatedly says that, he says, bavor ha-drash, derech ha-pshat, and sarah. Just because we have drash, we can still say pshat. He says, rach, b'taras, m'shpatim, v'chukim, when it comes to halacha, then he says, we have to nishanal mitasam of Chazal, b'li safek, b'yadayim chazakim, chalila, chalila, l'saref, matzidukim, chas v'shalom, to follow the tzidukim, who explains, literally, we have to follow Chazal in matters of halacha. He says, if we have two perushim, we have to be tachriya ha-kabbalah ha-emes, we have to allow the mesara, the Torah Shebal Peh, to decide which one is correct. Ibn Ezra says, Rak b'mitzvah sivuchukim esmach al kadmoneinu, when it comes to halacha, I have to rely on Chazal. Kefi divrayim, attacking dikdik l'shoneinu, chalila li mechata lakoni, chas v'shalom, for me to deviate from Chazal and halacha, etc., etc. Elsewhere. That's a good question. He says, Haklal, lo nucha lafar shal derech ha-mitzvah ha-torah peyre shalom lo nismach al derech Chazal. At the end of the day, so why on Chalev did he? Why on Yerusha did he? We don't know. Kasher ends his discussion by saying he doesn't understand what all this opposition to the Ben Ezra is. In anything, he says he's more faithful to Chazal when it comes to Psukim than a lot of the, when it comes to Halacha than a lot of the Balei Tosfos were. He says that the other Rishonim said that even when it comes to Halacha, we accept Chazal, but in terms of Pirush, we're allowed to explain Psukim even in ways that are different from Chazal, as long as we respect the fact that as a matter of halacha we accept Chazal in spite of our different reading of the Psukim. But the Ben Ezra said no. The Ben Ezra says even Derech Pirush we have to stick to Chazal on matters of halacha. In the last paragraph, Kasher says Amnam, he finally concedes Matzinu Gam LeBen Ezra LePamim Mevi Pirushim BePasha DeKrush Loka Halacha. Yep, sometimes I agree. Avali says Bederech Klal usually he doesn't do that. I don't know, usually I don't have a list of how often he does. The example of Chalev, we said earlier, the Chalev example, the correct shot seems to be, he was not expressing his own opinion that Chalev is mutter, he was just telling the Tzedukim, if you don't accept Chazal, this is where you should end up. You should end up with the bizarre conclusion that Chalev is never us, and even you know that's ridiculous. So he was just telling them that I have Torah Shebal Peh, I have no problem accepting Torah Shebal Peh. But you, if you don't want to accept Torah Shebal Peh, you should end up stuck. You should end up with some very strange conclusions. So you see that you can't get anywhere. You can't get anywhere without accepting Chazal. I myself, of course, I accept Chazal. So I accept that Chazal had a Mesorah. Chazal had Torah Shebal Peh that all Chalev is Asim Midaraisa. But they had an exception. They had a drasha for they had an exception for Aliyah, not Aliyah. But he himself certainly accepted Chazal that Chalev is Asim Midaraisa even on Chul. Now, some of the most controversial Ibn Ezra's, whether they're because of halacha or because of the dismissive attitude he had toward Chazal, there's a whole school of thought, beginning from the Chidah, going down later, that argued that not everything we have from the Ben Ezra is authentic. This is always a refute, but sometimes when certain Chachamim can't accept that someone else would have said something, they suggest that it was interpolated by Rishayim, that into the Ben Ezra's authentic commentaries, Minim or Tzedukim or Rishayim or Reformers, whoever they were, stuck their own stuff in as a means of infiltrating their material into a traditional Jewish source. Now, there were certainly Gedolei Torah who accepted this. I find it very hard to accept, partly because some of the things that were most controversial and people suggested were interpolations, we have fairly early sources, we've shown them already, who had no problem accepting they were the Ben Ezra. One of my favorite examples is we're taught, kids will come home from the Seder, they'll show you these pictures of, let's say, during Makas Dam, so Hashem turned all the water into blood, but whatever the Jews had, we were drinking water, and even if there was one cup of water and the Mitzri is drinking, he's drinking blood, and the Jew is drinking, he's drinking water, they show like little pictures with two straws, and the Mitzri straw is red, and blood is coming out, and the Jewish straw is clean water. The Ben Ezra says that Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinim, Dever, and one of the other ones affected the Jews as well as the Mitzrim. He said, if you read the Psukim, the first time, the first makkah the Torah says there was any distinction between Jews and Mitzrim was Arov. When it says Arov, it says V'hifla Hashem bein, God will distinguish between the Jews and the Egyptians. If you read the Psukim carefully, Dumb, it doesn't say anything about the Jews getting saved. Sfarde, it doesn't say anything about the Jews getting saved. Kenim doesn't say anything.
It says that the Mitzrim could, that Mitzrim dug around.
Right.
Right. Find
right. So the Torah does say, V'yachpru ha-Mitzrim l'mtzomayim. The Ben Ezra's language is, however the Mitzrim did, the Jews did the same thing. Yeah, the Torah says the Mitzrim did, but it means the Jews did the same thing. And he says there are five makkas in which the Torah does not say there was any distinction between Jews and Egyptians. Those five makkas affected the Jews equally. Why? Because those weren't so bad. The Mitzrim survived, the Jews survived too. The really serious ones, the really problematic ones, Hashem gave the Jews a break. The ones that weren't so bad, he says the Jews were affected too. Now we can debate in terms of other psukim. Is this plausible in the psukim? Is it not plausible in the psukim? But this was just such a kind of slap in the face, such a rejection of a famous and beloved Medrash of Chazal, that at least some of the super commentators on the Ben Ezra said he couldn't possibly have written this. This must have been a Talmud Torah put this in. Yet we find the Ralbag, as I recall, the Ralbag quotes this from the Ben Ezra and accepted this from the Ben Ezra. Ralbag himself was a controversial Rishon, but nevertheless, the point is, again, I don't know who understood the Ben Ezra better, the Ralbag or an 18th century commentator, but the point is, not everyone agreed that even some, again, this is only one passage, you'd have to do a study of all the controversial passages, see which ones were claimed to be Talmud Torah, but there were apparently prominent Chachamim who did believe that there were dastardly and terrible interpolations into the Ben Ezra, but it's not clear that that's historically correct. There's an interesting essay by on this whole topic, Ibn Ezra Beine Gedolei Hadaros, the Ben Ezra and the attitude of Gedolei Dar for the last 800 years by Rav Tzvi Yaakov Lehrer. He says that in terms of the really difficult Ibn Ezra, he has a summary essay discussing all kinds of different attitudes of the Achronim, Rishonim and Achronim. He says there are basically three approaches. He says some said when it comes to Drush, not Halacha, we can do whatever we want. And that was said by that as long as it's Drush, we can say it. As long as it's not a halachic passage, Chamas Yara said this. Other Sfardim said it. Sfardim said it. Igros Moshe. He says there were those who argued that we always have to try somehow to use our ingenuity and our utmost skill to somehow reconcile Ibn Ezra with Chazal, or in Bitumim, the Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson, others. We said that we have to try to do whatever we can to reconcile Ibn Ezra with Chazal. And some say he said that, some say it's just a Talmud Torah, that sometimes there are things that are just that we have to accept, are just interpolations, the Chidah and others. And he says, Rabbi Larry, you have to accept all three, because the first two approaches might work in some cases, but there are some Ibn Ezra's which are just such fundamental issues of theology or basic halacha, which there's no other solution except to say Talmud Torah wrote them. Again, a little hard to swallow. You have to see which examples he feels qualify and whether other Mefarshim agreed. But in general, these are the three approaches that people have took. Either that on Drush, you could say, you can explain differently. Perhaps even on halachic passages, you can explain differently as long as you're willing to accept that the halach is like Chazal. Or you can find clever ways of reconciling Ibn Ezra with Chazal. Or you can say it was a Talmud Torah, that it wasn't actually written by the Ibn Ezra.